India's general election, which begins today, will be the largest democratic event in human history. In the country of 1.4 billion people, a full 969 million are eligible to vote. And it's those numbers alongside India's complex terrain which means the voting will take place over the course of 6 weeks. So it's all clearly impressive in scale. But this year at least, the election won't have many people on the edge of their seats. And that's because pretty much everyone agrees Narendra Modi will walk it. The question isn't whether the incumbent will win, but the size that his majority will be. So what's behind Modi's extraordinary success? Well, the Indian economy is booming with headline growth figures of 8.4% last year. That's bound to help an incumbent. But there's also a darker aspect to Modi's popularity. In a supposedly secular nation, he has made his political career by appealing to an aggressive form of Hindu nationalism. And he's done so like no Indian prime minister before him. And Modi's Hindu nationalism, or Hindutva, has shaped this election campaign as well, which was unofficially launched this January at the opening of a Hindu temple.
In Hindu mythology, the deity Lord Ram returns to this city, Ayodhya, to be king after years in exile. In the tale of modern India, it is the crowning achievement of Narendra Modi's decade in power, with the inauguration of a brand new Hindu temple.
January the 22nd, 2024, is the dawn of a new era. This is a temple of national consciousness in the form of Ram. Ram is the faith of India. Ram is the foundation of India. Ram is the idea of India. Ram is the law of India. Ram Bharat ka
vidhan hai. Modi's opening of the Ram Temple in Ayodhya was the pinnacle of his decades-long campaign to empower and lionize India's Hindu majority. The idea that Ram, a Hindu god, is the law of the Indian nation may have been troubling to the country's 200 million Muslims. And Modi opening this particular temple was troubling for another reason. That's because the new Ram Temple stood on the grounds of a destroyed mosque.
There was once a mosque. It's believed the Babri Masjid Mosque had stood in Ayodhya since the 16th century, but many Hindus said it had been built on the birthplace of Lord Ram. In 1990, the BJP, Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party, turned that old belief into a new mass movement, calling for a Hindu temple to be built. In 1992, a mob tore it down. And in the ensuing days, riots erupted across the nation, killing thousands. Muslims today in Ayodhya still remember that day.
My heart and mind will always remember the day when people came here and spread violence. My family's house was burnt. What was our sin? Tell me.
An association with anti-Muslim violence is not a new feature of Narendra Modi's career. He rose to national prominence as chief minister of the state of Gujarat, and he ran the state when, in 2002, over 1,000 Muslims were killed in communal riots. Modi then was accused of having told Gujarat's police force to let the rioting happen, and his perceived complicity in that violence was enough to get him banned from the UK and the United States. But it wasn't enough to slow down his ascent to the pinnacle of Indian politics. And after 12 years as Gujarat's chief minister, Modi was elected India's prime minister in 2014, and that's a job he's held ever since. To discuss how Modi's Hindu nationalism came to dominate Indian politics, I was joined for this episode by Pratnav Anil. Pratnav teaches at Oxford University and has written two books on India, including Another India, The Making of the World's Largest Muslim Majority, that was published last year. This will be the first of a number of episodes I plan to do on India over the course of the election, each focusing on a different aspect of Modi's rule and Indian politics and its economy more generally. So do look out for those. For now, this is my conversation with Pratnav Anil. Pratnav Anil, welcome to Crash Course. Let's start with, I suppose, the big obvious question. Modi has been in power for two terms now. No one seems in any doubt whatsoever that he will win this election comfortably. The only question appears to be, you know, how big his majority will be. How should we understand Modi and his popularity? What makes him such a successful politician?
Well, I suppose you could say that Narendra Modi is, as it were, India's first Hindu nationalist, in that he's made it perfectly acceptable, respectable even, for Indians to say with pride that they're Hindu nationalists. So before Modi, the BJP trick was to call the Congress pseudo-secular, but now with him we see this new brazenness in its ranks. So Hindu nationalist used to be a term of abuse. No more, it seems so. And I think a great deal of his popularity rests on that fact alone. And then there is his past record as the chief minister of Gujarat in the early 2000s, which also endears him to his Hindu supporters. So in that role, he presided over the pogrom of 2002, preventing the police from putting a stop to that violence, and where his party mates were orchestrating a lot of violence in the streets of Gujarat. So he said that Muslims had to be taught a lesson, and he made sure they were. So something like 2,000 Muslims were killed by Hindu mobs, and something like 125,000 were displaced to refugee camps. And he won his first election on the back of that episode in 2002. And then we saw something quite similar transpire on the national stage 12 years later. So he rose to power on the back of the anti-Muslim Muzaffarnagar riots of 2014. So these two were orchestrated by BJP leaders in parliament, much like the Gujarat riots. And some of these chaps were called heroes by Modi on the hustings. So violence against Muslims, I think, is evidently what makes Modi such a popular figure in India. And of course, it no doubt goes a long way in explaining his appeal, but it would be remiss to ignore his opposition. So Modi comes to power after 10 years of Congress rule, and this is the Congress's last hurrah, as it were. So this is the party that ruled India uninterruptedly from 1947 to 2014. So these years witnessed non-existent growth rates, a massive population explosion, multiple wars, a dictatorship, unending corruption. So the corruption of the Manmohan Singh regime, this is Modi's predecessor, was the final straw. So in 2011, you saw an extra parliamentary mosque movement develop to overthrow the corrupt Congress regime. And as it so often happens with anti-corruption movements, they produce a right-wing backlash. Now, if you think about Manipulite in 1990s Italy, you know, which led to Berlusconi, or something similar in Brazil, the Lava Jato protests leading to Bolsonaro. So you saw something quite similar happen in India with the India Against Corruption movement giving way to Modi.
So you have a sort of, I suppose to put it in crude terms, you have sort of Congress, who are a somewhat sort of centre-left secular party. They've been in power for decades and decades and decades. They're sort of running out of steam. Then you say there's this sort of anti-corruption drive against them. And as we've seen in so many parts of the world, then a sort of right-wing populist comes to the fore and says, I will sweep away sort of the old institutions of the sclerotic party system, and I will sort of rule with a sort of, I suppose, some charismatic leadership. And I understand Modi is a charismatic man. Is that correct?
Well, certainly not in my opinion, but he comes across as a rather charismatic figure, you know. He has a sense of irony, which is saying quite a bit, given that his opposition tends to be rather deaf, you know, people who can't really hold their own at the hustings. And, well, Modi can, so he laces his speeches with sarcasm. He has these remarkable coinages that go down really well. And, of course, he manages to use technology to his ends rather well. So he was among the early pioneers of 3D holograms. So in a setting where something like half of the country's population is illiterate, it certainly goes down well when you have this mythic figure show up, and this is a 20-foot avatar, as it were, and people look at him, and what they see is really an avatar of Vishnu's. So he is charismatic in a, well, almost supernatural way.
And I suppose I want to get a better sense of what Hindu nationalism is and what its appeal is, because I suppose, you know, in your introduction there, you spoke a lot about sort of communal violence and pogroms against Muslims, essentially, which I assume is the darkest side of Hindu nationalism. What else does it offer sort of ordinary Indians that makes it so appealing? Because I assume, you know, the reason this guy has completely dominated Indian politics for the past 10 years and seems like he'll dominate politics for the next five can't purely be because people want to vote for someone who seems tolerant of anti-Muslim pogroms. Like there must be something else going on.
Well, Hindu nationalism begins as an ideology in the 1920s, and it's inspired by fascism and Nazism, and some of the early thinkers of Hindu nationalism make their debts to the brown shirts very explicit. So even their uniform is modelled on the Nazi uniform. And so the early years of Hindu nationalism tended to focus more on the caste angle. So this was some kind of de classe resentment that found its way into political life. So this was a time when the lower castes were coming into their own as a force. So the franchise was expanding in the 1920s and 30s. You had a number of anti-caste leaders, the likes of B.R. Ambedkar, something of a W.E.B. Du Bois figure, speaking about graded inequality and so on. So this is when Hindu nationalists decide to have an organization of their own, the RSS, the organization to which Modi belongs. And, well, the BJP, which is Modi's party, is part of the Sangh family, which is essentially a set of organizations that fall under the RSS. So what they decide is to keep the Dalits down and the Muslims out. So that's the sum total of their agenda. So initially, they read texts together, and they have a semblance of a charity network, they have a women's wing, and they have a social life which draws a certain kind of upper caste Hindu. And of course, as time wears on, you start having lower caste wings of the RSS as well. So they gradually branch out into disparate elements of society, but really their base is upper caste Hindus.
And so the RSS, so just so I'm clear, so the RSS is it's a youth organization principally, isn't it? So you can join it and then you'll take part in sort of exercises, sort of cultural activities. I mean, it looks a bit like the Hitler Youth. I mean, you could also say it looks like the Scouts if you wanted a sort of less sinister comparison, but it's sort of got that kind of imagery going on. And it's the RSS which develops much later. The RSS has been around for about 100 years. That develops much later into the BJP, so the political party which Modi leads. Am I correct there?
Well, so the RSS is founded in 1925, and yes, it is quite upper caste. It isn't purely a student organization, but the student wing is quite important to it. Even today, their student trade unions are the ones that dominate the country, the ABVP, it's called. So in 1948, Gandhi is killed by a Hindu nationalist, and this leads to the ban of the RSS. So that's when the RSS decides to have a political wing of its own. So it's called the Jan Sangh, and it's established in 1951. So the point is, if Hindu nationalism has to survive, the only way it can do so is by having representation in parliament. And the Jan Sangh is never very successful, and that's in part because the Congress Party, which is the hegemonic force in the country and at this point, has a fair number of Hindu nationalists themselves. So, and, well, the Jan Sangh ekes out a marginal existence till about 1980, which is when it morphs into the BJP, and, well, one thing leads to the next, and by 1996 they're in power for the first time. And from 2014 on, well, they've practically replaced the Congress now.
So I want to sort of I suppose, hone in on this difference between the Congress Party and the BJP. So, you know, for myself, I'm not an expert in Indian politics, and I know lots of our listeners, you know, but I don't think people in Britain have much of an understanding of Indian politics. I really want to go back to basics. So Congress is the party of Gandhi. It's the party of Nehru. So this is the party that basically, you know, led the movement for Indian independence. And that gave it sort of the right to be hegemonic in Indian politics for the first 50 years. And sort of key to their ideology was secularism. So the idea that India should be, or their official ideology, I know you might challenge me on sort of the reality of this, but sort of key to their official ideology is secularism. So India is for people of all religions. But I had, my understanding had been that they had a bit of a blind spot on caste, so that they were potentially seen as a bit of an elitist party dominated by the English-speaking elites. And then my understanding, and you might correct me here, is that the BJP was definitely not secular. They wanted, you know, the supremacy of India's Hindu majority. But my understanding had they had been a bit more inclusive when it came to the Hindu castes, because Modi is not from a high caste. He's not a Brahmin, is he? He's from, I mean, I almost, it seems strange to use this word, but he's from a backward caste. Now, again, our audience might think, why are you saying someone's from a backward caste? That sounds somewhat offensive. But I suppose, it's a long-winded question. Can you sort of, does my sort of very broad brush sweep analysis of sort of the relationship of those two parties to caste and religion stack up? And then I suppose, can you expand a bit on how our listeners should understand sort of the importance of caste in those two parties?
Well, I'd say you have a rather charitable view of the Congress. Well, as you've pointed out, there has been a lot of pushback to this notion that the Congress was such a great secular outfit, as it were. So I suppose you could say the Congress is the Americano to the Ristretto of the BJP. You know, it's just a more concentrated version of the Congress, you know, just a lot stronger. So the Congress is really just BJP light. So it's as early as the late 1800s when the Congress Party is formed that they discover the efficacy of religious appeals in society. So these are the early days of devolution, the extension of the franchise. And the lawyers and civil servants of the Congress need to find ways to, well, become more populist, as it were, to find a way of talking to the law orders. So one way they do that is by wrapping themselves in the flag, the saffron flag of Hinduism. So they whip up resentment against cow slaughter. They force Muslims to, well, worship idols. They have all manner of discriminatory policies. History textbooks are rewritten, and things get pretty nasty for the Muslims by the late 1930s. So that's when the Muslims form their own party. Well, they form it in 1906, but becomes a proper electoral force only in 1937. And 10 years on, you have partition and independence at the same time. So you get a Muslim Pakistan and, well, a Hindu India. And I suppose we ought to be putting Hindu in parentheses, because, as you say, the official discourse is that India is a secular, multi-confessional land and, you know, well, as that very cringeworthy phrase goes, you know, unity and diversity, you know, that's the kind of thing Nehru celebrates, you know. So this period is seen as something of a golden age of secularism, the mid-century. But in practice, there's not very much of that going on. So, well, the reality is quite bleak. You know, you have the massacre of some 40,000 Muslims in Hyderabad. You know, Muslims are fired en masse from government because they're seen as fifth columnists in the pay of Pakistan. And something like 100,000 Indian Muslims are deported to Pakistan. You know, they're just simply seen as foreigners, and Muslim leaders are thrown in jail as well. So you see, there's actually a lot of continuity between Congress rule and BJP rule. It just happens that the BJP is a bit more brazen about it, which is why by the time the Congress is completely discredited with dictatorship and corruption, it's quite easy for the BJP to steal a march on them.
And so I suppose in terms of the sort of anti-Muslim actions you're sort of talking about from the Congress there, so I suppose in my head you've got this period of partition, which, you know,
it seems like this very chaotic time, you know, it happens in this enormous rush. You have got some, you've got sort of grassroots pogroms on both sides, communal violence sort of popping off everywhere. And so I suppose I can see how the Indian state would have, you know, either proactively targeted or let down a lot of Muslims during that period of time. But this idea that Congress have always been a somewhat anti-Muslim party, does that sort of continue beyond that initial phase of partition, sort of into the following 50 years or so?
So the thing is, the Congress leader immediately after partition all the way to 1964, who rules for 17 years and pretty much sets the tone of government, is this rather enlightened chap, Jawaharlal Nehru. You know, he's been to Harrow, Cambridge, come back with ideas, had a bit of a dalliance with the left, sees himself as a bit of a socialist even. So he sets the terms of discourse. But in India, you don't really have much state capacity to begin with. You know, we're talking about a government where less than 2% of the population is in public employment. You know, I suppose the corresponding figures in, 50s Britain would be something like 15%, even the US. So we're talking about a state that barely exists outside Delhi and a few other metropoles. So the only way Nehru can rule is by having a dozen, hundreds of little Nehrus under him. Now, the trouble is these people aren't 100 little Nehrus, you know, they're little Indian nationalists. So the thing is, they can't really have a secular government when at a local level you just have Hindu nationalists running the show.
And let's move up to sort of the dominance of the BJP then, so the dominance of Modi and the BJP. And actually, let's go right up to the present day and talk about the Ram temple in Ayodhya. So this was, as far as I understand, kind of the informal launch of Modi's election campaign, which was to open this Hindu temple on the site where a very historic mosque had stood. So could you talk about the significance of that? Is this really a central element of sort of Modi's election campaign as it's sort of been described in the Western media, I think?
Well, I think the Western media has done a fairly good job of covering this, really. So the Ram temple represents, the fulfillment of a Hindu nationalist wet dream, and a wet dream of long standing in that. So it's a great moment to Hindus and by extension to the BJP. So, and we know it's important to Modi because he was in such a terrific rush to inaugurate it ahead of the election. So the Ram temple isn't even close to completion, so not even its first floor has been built. But the inauguration is still seen as something of a symbolic victory. So Hindus got to see Modi lather mascara on the eyes of their favorite idol. And it also represents, the vanquishing of India's unwholesome Muslim past. So Hindus, who anyway control everything from government to the economy to dominating the country's culture, still continue to believe that they're being persecuted by India's Muslims. So most of whom in the real world, that's outside the heads of Hindus, live a pretty miserable existence in slums. So building a temple on the ruins of the 16th century mosque is to them, the vindication of justice. And justice itself is already on their side because in 2010, the Allahabad High Court pronounced Muslims as the junior partners of Hindus in India. So legally, they said, Muslims deserve less rights than the majority community. And the apex court in the land, the Supreme Court, pretty much said the same thing 10 years later. So effectively giving carte blanche to Hindus to construct a temple on the ruins of the mosque. So now that Modi is finally delivered and, he has inaugurated this site, he can go to the hustings and tell Hindus that all's well in the world. The unemployment crisis might be a ticking time bomb. Public transport and healthcare may be a shambles, but hey, we have the Ram temple.
And I suppose I still want to understand why anti-Muslim sentiment is capable of mobilizing people, you know, with such force. What is it that people believe about Muslims? You know, so if you think about Islamophobia in this country, for example, sort of there's this idea that Muslims are all closet terrorists. You know, that's sort of the classic one. Or, I mean, obviously, you know, in a very sort of grim turn, you've also got you know, grooming gangs, sort of moral panics and the like. What makes anti-Muslim sentiment a politically mobilizing force in India?
Well, I suppose the elephant in the room is the existence of Pakistan. You know, so long as Pakistan exists, Hindus believe they've been denied a complete India, as it were, which should possibly encompass everything from Vietnam to Afghanistan. So if you look at maps Hindu nationalists draw in their free time, you know, it's always this rather expansive unit. So there's that, you know, Muslims are held responsible for dividing a country that was perfectly fine before the Muslims came into the picture. And then, of course, there's the rhetoric of Muslims having it too easy and being allowed to, well, conserve their rather folksy religious practices, well, some of which are quite far from progressive, to be honest. They include polygamy, unilateral divorce without alimony, well, discriminatory inheritance laws, sons being allowed twice as much as daughters. So there is Muslim personal law which continues to exist in India. So parts of it have been rolled back by Hindu nationalists when it must be said it should have been the secularists doing a lot of these policies. So there's that as well. So Muslims are seen as people who are completely cosseted by the Hindu leadership of yesterday, the Congress especially.
And let's just sort of pause a moment on this as well, because this would be unusual to a British audience. Because as far as I understand, secularism in... So when we think of secularism in this country, you think that, you know, that the law and religion shouldn't really cross paths. I mean, I suppose we're not a particular... You know, I mean, that's more of a sort of French vision of secularism. So if we're going to go to that strong vision of secularism that they have in France, you shouldn't have this connection between religion and the state. But as far as I understand, so Congress, the secular party, when India gained independence, it was established with two sets of laws. Now, obviously, in terms of, you know, I presume in terms of taxation and property rights and stuff, everyone follows the same laws. But then you get these personal laws, which sort of pertain to marriage, inheritance, as you say. And if you're an Indian person, then you will follow different laws pertaining to divorce, inheritance, etc. There might be, you know, more issues as well, whereby if you're a Muslim, you follow one law, and if you're a Hindu, you follow another. And that is quite unusual, right?
Right, yeah. There's a very long history of that, though. So it's in 1772 that Hindu and Muslim law is codified as such for the first time. So what the Brits do is they ask, pundits and Maulvis, Hindu and Muslim religious leaders, respectively, as to how to govern these lands that have just fallen to them. So inevitably, the Hindus say, hey, this is what Hindu law should look like. And the Muslims say, this is what Muslim law should look like. And so that's how you get these two different sets of religious codes. And things stay the same for the next 170 years, by which time it's become, well, by force of habit, I'd say, they just continue the same system in 1947. So there's a very large literature that's developed defending the genius of Indian secularism, as they call it, so which is nothing like French laïcité, as you describe, you know, with its unedifying principles of separating church and state. You know, they don't want any of all that. You know, that's seen as Western, you know, it's godlessness. You know, we don't want it here. So Indian secularism, in its rather nice terms, is understood as principal distance between the two faiths, Hinduism and Islam. So it's supposed to be more accommodating, unlike the unbending laïcité of the French. And it's supposed to have won over minorities, unlike, well, what you see in France today. But as I say, that's just the theory of it. In practice, it's an entirely different thing altogether.
You know, I think that geopolitical angle is something I hadn't quite... you know, really absorbed from reading Western coverage of this, the idea that sort of lots of the anti-Muslim hostility is actually based on this geopolitical beef with Pakistan, or I suppose it's not just geopolitical sort of conflict with Pakistan, it's the idea that upset that Pakistan ever existed in the first place. Modi talks about 1,200 years of slavery. What's he talking about?
Well, he really means Well, about 700 years of slavery, to be honest. He's just talking about the Muslim rulers of Delhi. And, well, before the Delhi Sultanate and the Mughals came along in the early second millennium, India was never ruled by Muslims, but rather by Hindus. So he has this rather long idea of history because it's perfectly convenient for Hindu nationalists to feel that they've been oppressed for a whole millennium. But really, the grouse begins in the 1930s and 40s. So that's when public memory really ends, you know, this partition. Before that, there's the Muslim League, which was formed, and that's all that really matters. So what they talk about when they talk about the Babri Masjid is really partitioned.
Okay, so when he sort of goes further back to maybe the role that Muslims played in the British Empire or the Mughal Empire before that, you think that's all just window dressing, and what really matters is we're talking the 30s, the 40s, and partition and what's happened since then. Just because I'm not sure we sort of covered it to the fullest extent, I'd like, let's talk a bit more about caste. And I suppose the fact that Modi is from a lower caste. What is the significance of that? And I suppose, is there a sense in which the Hindutva of the BJP has been, obviously it's very exclusionary of Muslims, but has in some ways it sort of created a more inclusive video of Hinduism? You know, so if you've got some visions whereby Hinduism is this incredibly hierarchical religion where you've got different castes and everyone has to sort of stay in their place, did the BJP sort of say, we're going to do Hindu nation building, and we're, you know, a modernist project in a way where sort of everyone within that religion at least is to some degree equal? Am I in any sense on the right track there?
Well, yes and no. So on the one hand, there is this inclusionary rhetoric. So, I mean, the idea is all Hindus have to come together against the Muslim threat. So in that sense, yes, all Hindus, lower caste and upper caste, have to come together. And in fact, the very important caste angle here is a lot of Muslims have been converting, a lot of Dalits, lower caste Hindus, have been converting to Islam over the last 50 years or so. So that's another reason why Modi wants to consolidate a Hindu bloc. So to bring the Dalits back into the Hindu fold, you know. So you have this whole idea of reconversion, because the idea is all Muslims in India are anyway Hindu. It's just that they've converted because they've a lower caste. So now the idea is to reconvert them back and bring them back into the Hindu fold. So on these terms, Hindu nationalism does appear to be some kind of ecumenical pan-Hindu ideology. But on the other hand, its whole business runs on a hierarchy within Hinduism. So the lower castes have to be kept down. You can't really have inter-caste marriage. Those things are still taboo in India. And the BJP very much upholds all of this. So it's more about telling Dalits, okay, we can bring you on board within this Hindu fold, so long as you know your place within the system. So they're against affirmative action for the lower caste. So in the 1990s, you had quotas being extended to the lower castes, the other backward castes, which is not a pejorative term, even though it sounds like one, but rather just a bureaucratic term. So the idea was we need to bring more of these people into universities, into parliament, and into public life more generally, into the services. So the BJP made great political gain by opposing the quotas. So the idea is, okay, Dalits do need to have a place in public life, but just not in parliament, just not in the higher ranks of government. You know, they're perfectly fine as sweepers and so on. So the very promise of social mobility is seen as some kind of sinister attack on Hinduism. So it's a Western idea.
That was the first part of my conversation with Pratnav Anil. To listen to the full hour, you can sign up at patreon.com/crashcoursepod for as little as £3 a month, or you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. That's patreon.com/crashcoursepod. Crash Course is produced and edited by Lewis Bassett and Patrick Herdman. Patrick Herdman does the sound design.